Boom! I've just welcome to the final bonus episode. I've just realised I haven't broken up this conversation between me and Michael in a very fair way. Fair? I mean, I tried to open up this podcast. This is my third attempt, because when I tried to word that sentence in the last attempt, I said I didn't try to compartmentalize this conversation in an evenly distributed way. What the fuck does that even mean? It's the problem with not doing A-levels, being an autodidact, is that sometimes you overstretch yourself and you overcompensate with your vocabulary and you end up talking fucking nonsense. That's a residual thing from when I was younger. And I'd have a vague sense of what a word meant, but I'd use it in the slightly wrong context. Now you grow, you evolve, your understanding of language becomes more advanced, so it doesn't happen very often, but it does still happen, as proven by that false start. What I meant to say is basically this episode isn't going to be very long because there's literally only like 6 minutes left of the conversation, whereas the past bonus episode has been like 40 minutes. But I might pad it out by doing something that I thought I'd never do, which is play some of the post-gig recordings that I have on my phone when I'm walking up the hill from the train station at 1 or 2 in the morning on the way back from a gig, when gigs were still about in that small interim between the two lockdowns and gigs started popping up again. Now they're gone. But furlough has been reintroduced. So we, thanks to our lobbying efforts at the LCA, so we partially. So there will still be venues and promoters, etc., when we come back from lockdown, and you'll be able to see me live, and buy. I mean, I'm not in demand at the moment, but when the book comes out, have a little bit more visibility, a bit more of a platform, maybe, possibly, if people don't detest my personality when they see me on different things or read the book, I might be a more marketable commodity. So then people will, but you lot, you are in at ground zero. You've been with me since I've been nothing. I'm still nothing at the moment, but eventually I might be something. And I will, at that point, completely fucking forget about you chumps, because I'll kind of outgrow you by that point. I'll be quite sought after. So I won't have time to like fuddle about with you little fucking cheapskates. Listening to a free podcast. No. The patrons. I've got some Patreon people. And the four of you that are contribute. Actually, it's grown a little bit, I think. That has contributed to my Patreon. I'm sticking with you. You've proved yourself. You've proved yourself financially. So no, I'm joking. I won't. I'm not that kind of person. I ain't outgrowing anyone, which is why I still have about 4 birds from when I was 7 years old. Never ended those relationships. No, I have a rigid commitment to the people in my life. Loyalty is very important to me, which is why I was still paying half of my rent and utility bills for towards the flat I shared with my ex for like a year after, because you know, I didn't want her to fall into penury. But I believe loyalty is an important thing, but then it can be used. It's got to be reciprocal. Donald Trump demands loyalty, doesn't really give any whatsoever in return. Everyone to him is dispensable, but he demands that they kind of genuflect to him, and the loyalty shouldn't be about that genuflection. It should be an equality to loyalty and to all human interpersonal relationships. Like my dad always said, like, no one's my superior. Someone might be my supervisor or my manager, but they are not my superior, because they are not superior to me. And a lot of the time, the people who float to the top are the biggest lumps of shite, or they're very careerist. They're people who in hierarchy or the management structure of a corporation or whatever, they're the ones who leech onto the assholes of those who are directly above them, and allow their supervisor to empty themselves into themselves. So they became a big taut cylinder of diarrhea. What? this should be edited, this podcast. I don't edit. I think sometimes the offcuts of conversation, the most extraneous parts of speech, can be inadvertently the most revealing. So I think it's good to keep them on, but sometimes they can reveal an ugliness, I believe. Like, there's a few times I've played with the tropes of, like, three occasions during this podcast, I've played with the tropes of anti-Semitism, and I'm worried it's going to be misconstrued as, like, revealing an actual prejudice. I did this earlier on as well in the podcast. I said, I've got friends who are Jewish. I've got Jewish on my mother's side. I read up on the history of the Hasidim and learn about Kabbalistic mysticism, and I love Jewish history. Reading up about the problems of anti-Semitism on the left. Maybe that's what it is. I have an awareness of these tropes, and yet they sometimes leak out during the normal flow of a conversation. I was actually going to do a podcast about anti-Semitism, but I've only got one left. I don't want to fucking waste it on that bullshit. I don't want to waste it on something trivial like anti-Semitism. So I'm going to probably do it about Christmas. Prizzy prezzies. No, I'm joking. I will do. I actually might do a patron podcast on anti-Semitism, or just Judaism. But then what are people who aren't Jewish? They say it in Curb Your Enthusiasm. Obviously, I haven't done that much reading, have I? Non-Gentile, that's it. I didn't even have to write it in because I just know it. Came to my mind easy because I had no knowledge. Gentile. But a Gentile talking about Judaism is a bit... I mean, does anyone want that? It's the same way as when you're asked as a male to give your perspective on sexism within the industry that you work in, within comedy, in my example, I think the most valuable contribution to that kind of discourse from a man is to acknowledge my own failings and complicity, rather than being a man talking about feminism, because women don't give a fuck. We don't give a fuck what I have to say on feminism. You're going to elevate other people's voices if people actually, you know, can talk authoritatively on feminism, like females, for instance, or me talking about black oppression or something. Yeah, no one wants that. Anyway, I've done a lot of filler just with this preamble at the top. 10 minutes, mate. Maybe we're only... Mate, I'll play you because I have, I'm sure, enticed you very, very much by promising my post-gig analysis recorded while really puffed out because my heart is blocked because I now weigh 17 stone. So those recordings of me walking up the hill giving a sort of post-mortem of how a gig went is probably orally displeasing because I'm puffing and huffing. Like a fucking tumor, wheezing man. Here is the final little bit of chit chat between me and Mickey W.
Yeah, I was trying to talk around it and I just couldn't be asked to fanny around, so I just kept deleting stuff just in case.
That was in reference to the MP who was going through it was accused of rape, I believe. I think rape is the accusation, to my knowledge. All I'll say is just write in MP rape on Twitter or something. You'll see who people are speculating. I'm actually at the moment wearing a jumper with them on it that I was going to save for like a bit of stand up that I had about him wanting to. Oh no, the bit of stand up was, it's not that good. It's when I once sent him two emails. One was about care in a community scheme that was being mismanaged, and the second one just said, "You are fat." And he only replied to the second one. And he replied with, "Tell that to my wife." And I replied, "Why is she fat as well?" He's also like an arcade. He's also like a fruit machine, a pub fruit machine that's been brought to life.
So, yeah, let's move on to another topic. Are we done now? Maybe we should be done now. We've done quite a few. I can't think of much else. Anything else? What's that Paul Thomas Anderson book like? Because I watched, as I said on Twitter, I watched his first film, Hard Eight, for the first time ever and liked it a lot. It's an interesting one. It's almost like you don't know what sort of film it is until about two-thirds of the way through. Like, I've sort of come away seeing it as like a neo-noir sort of small-scale crime thriller, but you don't really get that until you've watched the entire film, which I suppose is just one of the benefits of not really knowing anything about a film going in. Like, I haven't seen a trailer of it, I haven't read much about Hard Eight. Yeah, it's interesting. I think maybe it would have been more successful if it didn't have Samuel Jackson, Gwyneth Paltrow and John C. Reilly. Because, I don't know, it was such recognisable big stars. It almost elevates it above what it is as a sort of a low budget, sort of quite slight sort of neo-noir crime film. I think maybe with those stars, retrospect, like looking back, you expect more from it. And it's sort of maybe a bit of a surprise how slight the story is.
Just say Punch Drunk Love is my all-time favourite film, I think. Or one of them. I identify with that character. And it utilises the barely suppressed rage but also tenderness of Adam Sandler usually used in a comedy context in a serious film. And Adam Sandler's a brilliant actor, not a brilliant comedy actor, even though he is that as well, but just a brilliant actor in his own right. And it was a fucking travesty that Uncut Gems didn't get any nod at the Oscars. It's just, I don't get it. But then the Safdie brothers who directed it, I mean, there's also a value to being outside of the establishment recognition. And it allows them to carve their own niche, plough their own furrow, etc.
Yeah, I really liked it because it reminded me a lot of there's a series of comics I really love called Criminal by a writer called Ed Brubaker and an artist called Sean Phillips. And looking back at the film as a whole, it just feels like it fits so much into that Criminal universe. Like, it's really easily could have been one of the stories in the comics. It's like an anthology series, and I think Hard Eight would have fit that really well. But yeah, the lead performance, I've forgotten his bloody name now. But he was extraordinary. I thought he was incredible, and looked up to see if he was nominated for an Oscar that year, but he wasn't. But I think he really should have been. And I'm paying tribute to that performance by forgetting his name. So, but yeah, I thought he was incredible.
He's in a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson films. He's in Magnolia, where he played the game show host, and he was the library detective in an episode of Seinfeld.
But I don't think John C. Reilly was a star, was he? I don't know when it was made. I think John C. Reilly was... I thought that was like his breakout film. I don't know, I could be wrong there. I'll buy some of them Criminal comics. Yeah.
And I did, but I haven't read them yet. Like every other book I buy. I read. I flip between books. Like I've got like 30 on the go. I'll just keep bouncing between them.
I've been sort of getting back into graphic novels and comics and stuff. So I'm starting on one called A Contract with God by Will Eisner. But, yeah, we can end it there. We'll end it there on a nice note. And we'll bang out a few again in the distant future. Maybe do a Christmas, on the lead up to Christmas, do a little Christmas special. All right.
Yeah, I know, that's what I mean retrospectively, like watching it in 2020, you see John C. Reilly, Samuel Jackson, Gwyneth Paltrow, and, you know, I'm not sure where they were on their careers at the time. Obviously, Samuel Jackson had done Pulp Fiction, I think, by that point, and there's sort of echoes of that performance slightly. But yeah, I think I just mean like watching it for the first time from the vantage point of 2020, you sort of, it feels like there should be more weight to the story being centered around those performers. It's almost the sort of thing, sort of story and the sort of film you want to watch with unknowns maybe, but I wouldn't want to sacrifice the lead role. Obviously he's a well-known actor, but I don't know, maybe other people feel differently, but that was my impression.
Just quickly, what do you think of Phantom Thread? I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But tonally, there's a weird kind of tonal shift that was quite jarring. I know. Paul.
I think that's the thing with Paul Thomas Anderson. He doesn't know what. He doesn't know. He doesn't feel he has to make it clear what kind of genre his film is, what type of film it wants to be. So it will, there will be tonal shifts within his work, but it's all the better for it, to be honest.
Thomas Anderson is known for having tonal shifts within his film, but it's kind of like two different films from what I can remember cobbled together, but yeah, I mean, I loved it. What do you think? I better just warn you, in case if you haven't seen Phantom Thread, don't listen to the rest of this message here. But the reveal at the end of the Munchausen's by proxy dynamic, it didn't seem to be signposted throughout the rest of the film.
I think that's called foreshadowing. Foreshadowing.
But then from what, again, maybe I'm misremembering it. It was an unexpected reveal, which is meant to be. But usually there's like subtle foreshadowing to indicate that's what's going to happen. But there was that, but like in the final quarter of the film, if I remember, I don't know, maybe I'm misremembering.
And there we are. Ends on a garble and a whimper. That was boring. I did a brilliant podcast with the amazing Lucy Danza. Apologize if I'm mispronouncing your surname, Lucy. Lucy Danza. Lucy used to curate events at Camden Comedy Club, and she's an actress and a writer as well. And we had to talk about the five books that we hold dear. I picked Limmy's autobiography, Ulysses, The Castle by Kafka, The Bathroom by Jean-Philippe Toussaint, and then a book by Sally Tisdale called Harvest Moon, set in a care home, but it's non-fiction. It's from the 80s, but it shows how little we've moved on. It was the 80s in the US as well. But I recognised every part of that book, everything she was describing. And there's a few things I wasn't able to get through on the podcast from my notes, but I'll read from them now. So on Ulysses, I forgot to mention Why Ulysses Matters, the essay by Tom McCarthy. And I read this in the blue light of a Chinese restaurant while I was dining on my own. And it was my entry point into Joyce, or the first time I was able to properly access what was going on there. And the notes I've got, Joyce and shit, I spoke about that. Joyce's work is mired in excremental language, in excremental imagery, straight up scatology. Coming from Essex, there's an expectation that I'll be too loud or irredeemably vulgar, disreputable, disrespectful, and disobedient. So I really lean into that. And we spoke about this with Essex Girls on the podcast when it comes out. It's called Comics Books. So Comics Books. There's loads of episodes at the moment with a lot more famous comedians. So see if... listen to them all now. Go download it. Comics Books is called. And so does Joyce with the novel's degradatory machinery. And poetry turns into snot, nature, the very contours of the romantic sublime, its bay and shoreline, turn into a bowl, of sluggish vomit, or a bowel, ennobling the body's lower stratum, but I've said that a million times. Its excretative quality oversees a general debasement, a downpegging of all categories to a baseline of the bodily, of bodies ingesting or discharging other bodies. Forget Apollonian beauty. What Bloom wants to know is if statues of Greek gods have arseholes. Then Finnegan's Wake, morphic resonance, which is the interconnections between organisms and all of collective memories within species. A Jungian idea. And basically every organism in the world is one amorphous blob. And then Vico and his cultural patterns and cyclical history, that we have these historical ebbs and flows that repeat themselves in perpetuity. And then Jean-Philippe Toussaint spoke about Chris Ware, how it relates to that, the once againness, like in Chris Ware's graphic novels. And in Oblomov, another one of my favourite books. This is a recurring trope in my work. It reminds me of my drug-taking years, the frenetic standstill of just sitting in a flat that smelled like mints above a nightclub that sometimes banged out music in the daytime while my girlfriend was at work and I was sitting indoors in my little chamber, high off my fucking ever-loving tits. And Zadie Smith wrote that her students thought of the bathroom as an accurate portrait of their own denuded selfhood, or, to put it neutrally, a close analogue of the undeniable boredom of 21st century existence. Something we can relate to very much at the moment with it being lockdown, the quasi-repeating narrative loops, characters that retrace circuits through the corridors of a hotel. I've always wanted to do a series, it's like a three-part series of just me stuck in a bathroom. And occasionally I'll shit, occasionally I'll have a bath. But then whenever I climb into the water of a bath, a dead princess will come up as like a sort of spirit guide and cling to my back, and we'll have like a chat. Across the divide between being alive and being dead. I mean, she's sort of like a Princess Diana, but not her. And we talk about our lives and our depression, and then when I lie back down in the bath to wet my hair, and then come back up, she's gone. She's gone. Like, I read a short story about this woman who's in a failing relationship, and she has this African godmother figure. It's written by an African writer, so it'd be a version of that. Or like Hagrid, the little bloke who looked like my mate's Nanny Shirley in The Labyrinth. What was his name? Hoggle. Is that the correct name? Hoggle. The thing that annoys me about that film, The Labyrinth, is there's this little worm. Mike's girlfriend actually got a t-shirt of this worm because he frustrates me more than any character in a film, is that the entire film would have ended at like the 10-minute mark. But because he's an idiot, like, so he said, oh, if you'd gone that way, you would have gone straight to the Jared, you know, straight to David Bowie's knob bulge, but she went the other way, so there's actually a film, which might, you know, it just annoys me that he had one job, which was to direct her to David Bowie, and he failed at that one particular job. I hate worms. Fucking ignorant. All worms are ignorant. They amble through the modern urban landscape, amusing themselves by triggering and re-triggering an automatic doorbell, flirting with a pretty secretary, or failing to observe the etiquette and protocol of a posh tennis club, or dinner with the girlfriend's parents, to master the workings of cars or the rules of the highway code. The effect here stemmed from the naive individual's skewed encounter with systems larger than himself, an encounter which, reprised again and again and again and again, perfectly plays out Bergson's first rule of comedy, that life should be reshaped into a self-repeating mechanism. Which is why I always bang about worms and other things that you hear me repeat. Anyway, I'll end it there. Love you all. Final episode of the season next Tuesday. But if you're a Patreon, I'll continue to do bonus episodes until the end of the year. For the rest of you, 2021 for the next series.